Hey, 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 hey! It's Monday, it's a religious studies project time. I'm Christopher Cotter.
I'm David Robertson.
And yes, we are the religious studies project, brought to you in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. I'm so happy, David, because I've just got married. Or rather, will have done by the time this has been recorded. And, you know, I've never, ever heard of any, you know, anyone not being happy after they've got married. So that's entirely... That's why I'm so happy.
First of all, don't mess with the timelines, okay? You know, you're not married now. For the people listening, you are married. So that's confusing already. And secondly, really, you've never heard of somebody getting married and not being happy?
Yeah, this all sounds a bit Christopher Nolan, messing with the timelines. Anyway, other beings which can potentially mess with timelines are spirits.
Yeah, well, you know, people may not always be happy after they get married, but they're often not also happy after they die. Doesn't mean they don't want to hang around and communicate with us. And it stands to reason that in societies in which such a postulated spiritual realm, that there would be human agents who were trained in dealing with them and communicating with them.
Absolutely.
So with that in mind, let's go to David Wilson, who's going to tell us about the connection between spiritualism and shamanism.
I've got the pleasure of speaking today to David Gordon Wilson, a longtime friend of the project, but we're going to talk today about his research, and in particular his recent Bloomsbury monograph. Came out in 2013, just came out in paperback, entitled Redefining Shamanisms. David is a independent scholar, bookshop owner, writer, and spiritualist medium, amongst many other things. And his take on spiritualism particularly, and also shamanism more broadly, is a very interesting case study for a lot of reasons, not least David's unique take on the insider-outsider issues of the field. Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start today, though, with how you came to be studying spiritualism in the first place.
Right. Well, there was an element of serendipity, but there is context to that, as always. I began to get a bit bored with life as a lawyer and started thinking about other things to do, and for one reason or another settled on going back to Edinburgh University and doing a degree in divinity. So I have interests in early Christian history, philosophy, psychology of religion as well. And doing divinity enabled me to explore all of those in some way. As part of that degree, I had some freedom to pick and choose courses because I wasn't planning to go into ministry. And one of the courses I took into that was Jim Cox's course on shamanism at Edinburgh University. And returning to Edinburgh from living abroad and picking up the threads with my parents once again, in terms of being around them regularly, I found that they had become quite active members in a spiritualist church in Edinburgh, Portobello Spiritualist Church, which I started taking an interest in just out of personal nosiness, really. But I did take that to the point of joining the church and then becoming a member of that church's development circle, which was its teaching forum for training new mediums. And I was doing the course in shamanism at the same time as that sort of experiential activity in the church. And I started noticing a lot of correspondences in terms of lore, if you like, that was handed down within the movement, and various mediumistic practices, and a lot of the things I was learning and reading about in shamanic traditions. And that was intriguing, because at that point in time, if you had suggested to people that spiritualist mediumship was a shamanism. That would have raised a few eyebrows, and did, although it seems to be becoming more familiar to people now. So I noticed lots of correspondences, which is interesting in itself, and eventually I thought, well, maybe there's a PhD in here in characterising Western mediumship as a particular shamanic tradition, and seeing if that worked. And in the course of the PhD, the more interesting question occurred. Yes, these correspondences are there. The more interesting question is, why does that happen in two such different cultural settings? I mean, the shamanisms we were looking at for the course were mainly traditional shamanisms, so very culturally contextualized local traditions. The interesting question is, why do you get these correspondences in very different cultural settings at different times in human history and in different parts of the world?
Let's, before we get there, unpack, if we can, this specific cultural context then of our modern Western world and spiritualism. First of all, you talk about spiritualist church. If you can sort of give us spiritualism in a nutshell and really what its role is.
Interesting. Or challenging question. I talk loosely of a spiritualist church. The particular church that I became a member of and did my ethnographic participatory research in was a congregational church, a standalone organization, but which regarded itself as part of the wider spiritualist movement. And the word movement is often used because not all spiritualist centers regard themselves as churches. Some will use a different terminology, even though the origins of the movement are very obviously Christian, or derived from Christian forms of worship and organization. The other reason for being in a movement that is, organizationally, it has tended to be quite weak. There is no one overarching spiritualist organization, although there are one or two quite influential ones that have an influence, you know, even with churches who are not formally members or affiliates. So it's quite a loose movement. And that lack of organization immediately means that, in answering the question, why does this hang together and persist as a tradition in a society that is, you know, more widely very ambivalent about mediumship often. You know, Western society at one and the same time gives sufficient social space for spiritualism to exist and to continue, but at the same time limits it quite severely. And in some cases excludes it from public discourse, for example. It's a very contested social space, but it is there and it perseveres. And the weakness of organisations obviously suggests that something else is allowing that to happen. And it was the idea of spiritualism as a tradition of practice with some mechanism for transmitting knowledge of those practices that starts to be the answer as to how that movement persists over time. So it's really a tradition of practice rather than belief or teaching. One of the other things that characterises spiritualism is constant debate over teachings and understandings of what, you know, spirit worlds and how communication is actually achieved. So it's a movement that's curious in as much as it lacks a theology, even as it draws on a lot of Christian language for its own dialogue.
It's interesting you say that it's, you know, that we give it enough space, but at the same time it's marginalised. I mean, I'm thinking of there's quite a sort of movement within the field to start looking anew at these kind of practices and beliefs, for want of a better word. I'm thinking particularly of kind of Martin Stringer's Western Ethnography volume, and also Marion Bowman's work on vernacular religion, Leonard Primiano as well. Because it turns out, actually, although this is marginalised in terms of its role public role,
yes,
these kind of beliefs are enormously widespread.
They are, and Stringer's work particularly brings that out, that in terms of public discourse, whether it's a wider political level or in terms of academic discourse, these practices are often excluded. And it can be quite hard work getting them brought back in some way. And yet, in terms of private practice, outside the context of formal organisations, particularly, or churches, there is an awful lot of this activity going on at ground level, which gets missed. It's all kind of off the academic radar.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons it gets missed is because there are no obvious organisations or bodies that you can go and just have a look at and explore and see the history of. To actually map the full extent of this activity, it takes work that really is down at the coalface of speaking to individuals and small communities and networks, private networks of individuals very often. And that's precisely the kind of research that is hugely time-consuming and expensive and open-ended.
And yet that's exactly what you did.
That's exactly what I did. I mean, I had the advantage of having enough cash to be able to do it, so I didn't have to go pleading and arguing my case. And I had the real luxury of just going in to a situation fairly open in terms of what I might find there and what use I might make of that. Mm. And that actually was quite a privileged position to be in, because it's not one that many researchers actually enjoy. Normally, when we're looking for resources in terms of time or cash, we have had to make a particular case as to why this research is worthwhile, what might come out of it, and what we're going to do with it afterwards.
Yeah.
And that often includes settling on a particular methodology. And I had the luxury of not being wedded to any particular methodology or any particular expectations as to what might be there, or even whether it might be worth looking at. I mean, I took the risk that it might not be.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that sense, it was quite an unusual piece of research.
Well, I suppose in that case, you could have just done a fairly standard ethnographic work, you know, mixing your experiences there with the history of spiritualism, for instance, would have been an easy enough thing to do. But one of the things that's very interesting about your book is that it isn't really that. I mean, it is that to a degree, but it's also making this much larger, dare I say, comparative point between, you know, this specific specific context of spiritualism and then this broader academic category of shamanism. So perhaps you could start by saying a little bit about shamanism as how you view the category for a start, and then leading into how you began to make this comparison.
Yes, one of the difficulties of shamanism is defining exactly what it is that you're talking about, because it's a term that has become so widely used now in so many different contexts. It's almost impossible to use it without giving further explanation of exactly what you're looking at. And one of the things I did in the book deliberately was to settle upon one particular shamanic tradition. And I went back to the Evenki, or the Tungus, as they used to be called, because that is where we get the word shaman from.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if I could do a comparison between that tradition and Western, principally British, mediumship, then that's quite an important step forward, because I didn't want to be accused of, first of all, distilling a convenient version, generic version, cross-cultural version of shamanism and saying, oh, look, this fits, because you can almost make it happen. Whereas if I would force myself to look at one particular tradition in its particular social context, there is a very clear case study there that is a better test of whether a comparison can actually be drawn. And the particular nub of the comparison that I felt was the process of apprenticeship, that mediums go through in spiritualism, and which was, and my account of that was particularly born of my time in the development circle at Portobello, and then looking particularly at Shirokogorov's work on the Evenki to see if that same apprenticeship was present. And interestingly, it was. And it, not only was there an apprenticeship present, there was a very particular sequence that I had noticed in mediumship within spiritualism, which was also present in the Evenki tradition. Slightly different content, but the same structure was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a way, answered the question as to why there were these correspondences of practice. Because you can see the same mechanism at work in both traditions, despite those very different cultural settings. And that then led me on to think, well, maybe that particular apprenticeship structure can be found in other shamanic traditions, and maybe that can then form a coherent but still flexible basis for defining the category shamanism, which has proved incredibly problematic for scholars, even though it's a model that's been very heavily used in North American scholarship. Quite what people mean by it varies enormously. And a lot of the debate within shamanism is about, you know, do we talk in terms of shamanism or shamanisms? You know, shamanism, in a sense, is an academic category, whereas which contains lots of different shamanisms, because these are traditionally very local, very particular traditions. You know, they have a very clear cultural context.
So you have distilled then, or argued that there's this apprenticeship structure that we can use that to think about shamanism in a slightly different way, and perhaps define it in a in a workable way for, you know, away from Eliade's kind of
I mean, the part of the beauty of that is that you've identified, in a sense, the skeleton, and it leaves room for different content from one tradition to another in terms of particular shamanic practices, particular expectations of what a shaman is going to do as a practitioner. But you can see that same structure whereby they get there.
Could you,
that same process.
Could you outline that structure?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly simple in one way. I mean, the pattern broadly is that there are some socially recognized signals that someone might be a potential shaman. Some writers will talk about it as a call by the spirits. It might be a feeling of not fitting into society. It might be a feeling of isolation. You know, some cultures, it's recognized that this involves withdrawing and disappearing off from the community for a year or two even. Events, to, you know, physical happenings, if you like, around the home or the person. It might be difficulty sleeping because there are very intrusive dreams. There might be visions. You know, some kind of interruption of normal life that is characterized as a call by the spirits or the beginnings of that person's awareness that there might be something more that they're going to have to engage with or are being invited to engage with. So that first phase is certainly there across cultures. The particular content varies, obviously, in terms of what's recognized as important or significant. And that then goes on, and a response is then needed as to whether to pursue that or not, or to try and deny it. I mean, in most cultures, if you try to ignore it, it just comes in even stronger until you actually do something to take it forward. So the next stage then is basically apprenticeship to an existing practitioner, but also apprenticeship to the spirits. So there's two concurrent processes of learning going on there. So your existing practitioner can pass on earthly lore, if you like, knowledge of the kind of practices that are traditionally expected and perceived as valuable by the community that's being served. And at the same time, what is having to be learned is this process of communication with the spirits, which is something that's the existing practitioner might be able to help with in terms of sharing his or her own experience, but which ultimately the candidate or apprentice needs to work at with the spirits rather than in this world.
Yeah. It's a little like academic writing, you know. Your supervisor or whatever can help you present it and show you where your weaknesses are, but nonetheless, it's your thought that's going to be
the constant. It is your thought and your enthusiasm and your determination and your hard work, which is done by going off and doing it, you know, separately from any engagement with your tutor, if you like. So that's the kind of second stage. And then, I mean, either you're the earthly learning, if you like, or the tutoring, part of what that passes on is a language that you can use to engage with the spirits, you know. So it's a tool set that you can start to use in various ways. But becoming proficient at using them is something that the candidate has to achieve pretty much on his or her own, except that from the insider perspective, it's not on their own. They're doing it in engagement and in relationship with other tutors.
Yes, yes.
So that middle stage then comes to the point where the tutor or existing practitioner will say, well, we think you've taken this far enough to be recognized as a practitioner in your own right. And all cultures, including mediumship and within spiritualism, have a process, if you like, or perhaps even an event or a particular demonstration whereby the candidate is recognized as a practitioner. And the important qualifier there is that recognition needs to be maintained. It can't be taken for granted. You know, just because you've been given your degree or your certificate doesn't mean to say that you're going to be indefinitely recognized as someone who has done something worthwhile. You've got to keep working at it. You've got to keep in the public eye. And the expectation in most traditions is that having been recognized, a practitioner will then go on to do more and better work over time, adding to their skill sets, becoming more and more useful, more and more powerful, a better medium or shaman. So it's still an ongoing process. And in a lot of traditions, you will hear practitioners say that their apprenticeship never stops. So although they've achieved recognition, they're still having to develop.
Yes, yeah.
And you find exactly that in spiritualism as well. I mean, the number of mediums who have said to me, you know, you never stop developing.
Yeah. And that's you hear that in sort of magical circles as well. The initiation never ends. Initiations within initiations. And
yes, it's this constant process of affirmation, recognition. And of course, you know, in a lot of cultures, some practitioners who have been recognized will subsequently fall off the circuit or what have you, because they're no longer recognized as proficient. Some don't manage to make it all the way through the apprenticeship. You know, they fall off at some stage because it becomes too challenging personally. And I saw that happen within spiritualism. But, you know, Shrokogorov's work in the Evenki gives examples of exactly that happening there as well.
So, you alluded to this earlier on, but I think we've got to the place where we can discuss this now. So why does this happen in these different cultural and historical contexts? And you know, what did you take home from
Well, I suppose the blunt answer, the short answer, with my insider hat on, is simply that, you know, these entities, spirits, whatever you want to call them, are real. Within spiritualism, and, this is the other interesting thing. Once you start looking at traditional shamanisms, there's a much heavier emphasis upon speaking to the souls or spirits of departed people than is sometimes appreciated in accounts of traditional shamanisms, because a lot of the scholarship can give quite heavy emphasis upon the connection to the natural world, animals, nature spirits, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And those do have a place, as indeed, interestingly, they do have a place in spiritualism as well. But looking at the ethnographic material, there's often a much heavier emphasis upon human spirits. And Shirokogorov does say that among the Evenki, it's overwhelmingly human spirits that shamans are engaging with. Which isn't always the impression you get from reading shamanic modern shamanism.
Do you think there was an unconscious bias in those early ethnographers to present it that way?
That is an interesting question.
Did it fit more with a sort of implied model of what primitive religion was like or something like that?
Possibly. That's probably a criticism I would be more likely to make of someone like Iliada, for example. Mm-hmm. Shirokh Grof, I always, you know, having read his work, I've come to regard him as offering an extremely good example of how to conduct ethnography. Because he is surprisingly modern in his lack of bias, even though his work was produced, you know, on the basis of fieldwork done during the time of the First World War.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason he was overlooked is because his work went against a lot of the prevailing psychological explanations of shamanism that were current in the academic era at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he was a bit of an outsider in that sense.
Well, it might actually be then not so much not an unconscious belittling of the material, rather trying to avoid things that he saw might lead it to being viewed as primitive or whatever. And
yes, that's right.
It although, might be a positive interpretation.
It is, although, I mean, his material is full of examples of shamans behaving in ways that are not in the least bit impressive. You know, he's... and this is one of the interesting things. You know, he doesn't present it as religious in the sense that it is spiritually elevated. I mean, one of the interesting things about shamanism, and also, you know, spiritualist mediumship, is that the reasons for doing this stuff, for engaging in these practices, are often very, very practical. There is a practical outcome expected or sought as a result of each engagement. So it's interesting in Shirokh Grof's work. You know, he does present a lot of examples of media of shamans engaging in ways that are clearly motivated by personal interest. And that might be an extension of...
Like their personal interest, it not be. The interest of the community. Or...
Well, it can be. But there is a sense that, you know, with shamanic practice, there is always a practical objective, and that might be protecting your clan, it might be getting information from spirit as to where and when to hunt, help with diagnosing an illness of a client, you know, very practical objectives. Might be information about when to migrate, you know, because, you know, the Evenki were a nomadic culture, so they might ask the advice of the spirits as to when to make their next shift in terms of physical location.
Yeah.
There are also times when, you know, people might be under threat from the shamans of competing clans, so part of the shaman's function will be to protect his community or her community. Shamans are also people who conduct the souls of the dead to the right place. So, you know, a kind of... you can almost draw comparisons there with exorcism in the Western tradition. You know, if you get someone being pestered by somebody who's died and hasn't gone to where they should go, they're causing a problem.
Yeah.
So we want to explain to them where they are, that they are dead, and tell them where they should be going. So part of the shaman's job is, you know, to act as psychopomp, that conductor of the dead. Female shamans are often involved in childbirth because this wasn't just a birth, it was a new soul coming into the world. And again, that's a different sort of conducting a soul to a new place that it should be going to. It's coming into this world rather than going to
that. But you can see the connection is clear.
Exactly. So, I mean, you get this broad range of skills, but all of which have very practical objectives. Mm-hmm. They're not theoretical spiritual teachings in the way that we might expect them to be.
Yeah, it's not an abstruse theology. It's a very practical.
Yes, it's a knowledge tradition that's embodied in practice.
Yeah.
Although a lot of shamanic traditions, including the Evenki, do have creation accounts, for example. You know, they do have narratives about where we came from and how the world was created and why they came to be living in that particular part of it, and what their relationship is to the creator. But again, you know, you find a lot of parallels with this within spiritualist mediumship, because spiritualist mediumship has very practical objectives. It seeks to demonstrate personal survival beyond death, you know, showing people where the souls go after death. You get plenty of accounts in spiritualism of rescue circles, which have as their objective breaking connections between people in this world and people in spirit that are proving unhelpful or damaging, a kind of exorcism, disobsession. Rescue circles, they're sometimes called. So many parallels between two culturally very different traditions. But again, there's that broad range of practical objectives.
Yeah, yeah. We've got the last couple of minutes. It'd be great if you could tell us your reflection on this, or the ethics and the emics of well, what you've done specifically, but how you see that reflecting the larger field in particular. I mean, you went into this as an academic and came out of it an insider as well.
Actually, I would put that the other way around. I kind of went into it and gradually became an insider, and from that became an academic.
There's an interesting...
Yeah. So I'm not an academic who's gone native. I'm actually a native who's gone academic. and as part of that process, you know, I have taken on board the need to be critical, not only of my own... religious or spiritual tradition, but of myself as a practitioner within that, and of myself as an academic, because you know, in a sense the bar is slightly higher for me, because I know that other academics will be looking at me with a slightly more critical eye. So what I produce in terms of academic credibility, it absolutely has to be there.
Can I give you a reflection? Which it's actually quite a compliment. I am one of those kind of scholars who's very cynical about insider accounts in academia.
Well, I can be, because some of them are rubbish.
Yeah,
frankly.
What I like about you, though, is that you're completely clear about it. And when I'm listening to you talking or reading the book, I'm never in any doubt which hat is talking.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of scholars, particularly doing the kind of fields that you and I both do, who go back and forth all the time and don't appear to be aware that they're doing it, no matter what their statement of theoretical intention at the beginning of their work.
I think that's something I learned in my career as a lawyer, because you know, when we're drafting legal documents of any length, we put all our definitions at the beginning, and you absolutely have to use those carefully all the way through, otherwise the effect of a document as a whole is lost.
Yeah,
and the consequences can be horrendous in the context of, you know, important legal transactions. But that same training comes in making it clear which voice is speaking in my work, and getting used to inhabiting slightly different worlds and negotiating that divide. Because there, you know, one of the reasons I make use of my insider experience is, in a sense, to step out of it and reflect upon it and be critical of it, and just keep looking for inconsistencies, testing your own understanding. Because and part of that is actually accepting that very important scientific approach that knowledge is, in a sense, always provisional.
Yeah.
Even as an insider who has certain things I trust in as real and which I rely on in practice on a day-to-day basis, ultimately I have to say, well, you know, yes, okay, we do get back to that, you know, Cartesian viewpoint that the only thing I can be absolutely certain of is my own existence. And beyond that, I just have to work on the basis of what seems to work so far. Knowledge is always provisional, and we have to be reliably informed and aware. We have to keep re-examining ourselves. We can't do that in practice, but you know, there are certain things you have to just say, well, okay, I'm going to take that as granted and examine this area today or for the next year or 5 years or whatever. But that constant self-criticism has to be a feature of good academic work, and of adding to human learning. No, it's all incremental, and it's an openness in critical thinking. It's an openness to having one's own thinking changed, you know, because that is actually how we learn. If we're not open to being changed at all, we're never going to learn anything. So, you know, if you're going to put yourself out as a teacher, you have to embody that openness.
Yeah. that's a perfect place to stop.
Good.
Yeah. So be open to David's book. I do urge you to read it. It's well worth reading, and there's a lot of detail in there that obviously we had to skim over. Thanks as ever to David, and I imagine you will be hearing more from him quite soon. But for now, goodbye from the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, David. David's, I should say. Great to have David Wilson on board, and the second time round, because you know that there was a repeat interview after our one and only technology fail, and luckily that technology fail happened with David, who was understanding and very able to be re-interviewed.
The other recording, we did lose two recordings on that day, but the other one was the
Christmas special.
Christmas special, which we had a second source recording.
So you hear that people always take a backup.
Always have a backup. Yeah,
yeah,
but that imagine we'd lost that.
Well, it was a very, very fun day, and you made sound effects and everything. Not during your interview with David there, which it was very good to hear him again, and talking about shamanism, particularly on the continent being Europe. There's a sort of very established study of shamanism, which I don't think we get so much in the sort of UK, US centric sort of Anglophone discourse that we have. So it's good to get into the shamanism.
I'd be very, very critical about the idea of shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of Eliadian kind of essentialist model of religion.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's something that we hadn't touched upon before.
David, I think, is aware of those concerns, and actually his work, I think, strengthens the model of shamanism as much as it strengthens spiritualism, if you like.
Absolutely. So we've not really got too much in the way of RSP news, except just to let you know that it's all ticking along quite merrily at the moment. We've got plenty of interviews recorded, loads more lined up. The AAR will just have happened, I think, by the time this podcast goes out.
It might still be going on.
Everything's ticking along fine, and we've got a lot of we hope that you think that the quality of the podcast is improving as the years go on, and we certainly do, and we're really looking forward to bringing you the ones that we've got in the bag. Next week it's Tommy Coleman speaking with Tanya Lerman, largely on her book When God Talks Back. What's the actual title of the interview there, David?
Prayer, Pretense and Personification: How God Becomes Real.
Yeah. So Tanya Lerman is one of the most eminent scholars of religion in the world at the moment. So.
And then good to have Tommy back, one of our most eminent interviewers.
Yeah. In terms of this week, are there any interviews that people might want to listen to from our back catalogue? There's Antaves and Religious Experience, there's the Paranormal Esalen ones.
And the recent roundtable involving David Wilson with what was it called? Studying Non-Ordinary Realities.
Indeed.
Yeah, and then, there's been a strong theme of that. Particularly this kind of season, but over the years as well. Yes, much to delve into there. We'll try and link to them in the description of the interview when I write it. I'm just realising that I haven't actually written it yet. Should have done that weeks ago.
Naughty.
Never mind, I'll do that now. Other than that, the other thing that people should remember is that they might want to use our Amazon link. Links.
The holiday season, this secular holiday season is approaching.
Generic holiday season being in the air, but also use our Facebook, iTunes, Google+, and Twitter accounts if you want to stay in contact with us. Do send us an email at editors@religiousstudiesproject.com if you want to get in touch with us for suggestions, complaints, queries, anything else that you want to send in our direction. I think, you know, not sort of advertising and stuff. We're not going to buy stuff.
No.
We don't have any money.
Yes, this is, the project is you know a different thing, but yes, anyway.
Yeah, if you're looking to sell marketing, you know we're not your target market. But other than that, we'll look forward to seeing you all back here this time next week.
Thanks for listening.